Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of arts and cultural events. For Alan Farley, I'm David Latulipe. An extremely content-rich program for you today, dear listener, with an hour that will include conversations with conductor Vasily Petrenko, who is conducting the San Francisco Symphony this week, with tenor Stephen Costello, who makes his San Francisco opera debut, and Jake Heggie's Moby Dick next week. We'll also talk with Janice Lieberman of the Sierra Ensemble, who is performing tomorrow as part of the Old First Concerts series here in San Francisco. Plus, I'll share a conversation my colleague Sarah Cahill had this past Sunday with Paul Drescher. Paul's Concerto for Quadricord, an instrument he invented, has its world premiere tonight in Berkeley. Tonight, as part of the season opening concert of the Berkeley Symphony Orchestra, a concert which we'll be broadcasting in December. Let's begin with opera and an audio excerpt from my guest Stephen Costello singing Greenhorn's aria, I See, from Jake Heggie's opera, Moby Dick. With a libretto by Herman Melville, adapted by Gene Shear, we heard Stephen Costello singing an excerpt from I See, from Jake Heggie's opera Moby Dick. Stephen Costello joins me in studio now to talk a bit about the opera. Stephen, welcome to KLW.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Not a bad role to be making your San Francisco opera debut with, alongside J. Hunter Morris as Captain Ahab.
Yeah, he's incredible. I have to tell you, when we did it in Dallas, I had done it with Ben Heppner, and I said Ben is the only Ahab that can possibly be out there. And from the first rehearsal when we got to San Francisco, J. Hunter Morris was just mesmerizing. I mean, he embodies the character. I mean, he is Captain Ahab. We have a running joke now that every time we see him, we call him Captain J-Hab.
Now, wait a minute. I thought he was Siegfried.
Well, he can do whatever he wants to do.
For listeners' edification, he's done an amazing Siegfried, not only with San Francisco Opera, but for the live Met broadcasts, which were just stunning.
He is. I was at the Met in when he jumped in. And I remember standing in the wings at one of the rehearsals and watching him. I was this new guy, J. Hunter Morris. And he came in and sounded fresh and great. And I was just extremely thrilled. I was thrilled for him. And then when I found out that I was going to get to work with him finally in here in San Francisco, I was over the moon. He's a great guy.
Now, you speaking of the Met broadcasts, you were heard in one of the Met broadcasts as well, the live and HD broadcasts.
Yeah, and it's Percy and Anna Blana.
Those must be exciting.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Because you have a camera that's actually, it's almost like I was telling somebody, it's almost equivalent to like NFL TV. I mean, I went to my first NFL game and they have cameras on these wires going back and forth over the field. And when you're at the Met in HD, you have cameras in the audience, but you also have one that just travels across the the edge of the stage. And sometimes when you're on the ground or on, you know, laying on your back or on, or something on the stage or on your knees, the camera's just right there in your face going back and forth with you. It's really, really kind of cool.
But not distracting.
No, not distracting at all. They actually have the cameras in place for a performance prior to that, just so you get the feel of it and you're not distracted by it when it's a live performance.
This production of Jake Heggie's Moby Dick is a co-commission of the San Francisco Opera with earlier performances by the Dallas Opera, which you sang with. It's also a co-production with Calgary, San Diego Operas, and the State Opera of South Australia, first performed in Dallas in 2010. Mm-hmm. Now, coming into a role that is as new as this one, by a contemporary, fortunately lyric composer like Jake Heggie, nonetheless must pose some special challenges compared to, say, something like Rodolfo from Bohème.
You know, it's funny. It's funny you say that. We had an insights talk last night, and that was one of my comparisons. I do a lot of standard rep, and when you do a role like Rodolfo in Bohème, I mean, Bohème has been around for years and years and years, and you have maybe 40, 50, maybe 100 different recordings that are out there of La Bohème, and you are then taking a role that everybody knows and putting your mark on it. When you do something like this, Moby Dick, you're doing a role that has been done this is the third time in the United States it's been done, and I had done the first performance in the United States of the role. So you're taking a role that no one has really heard, and you're not only making it your own, but you're also trying to bring across how great the music is, and you're trying to make the audience respond to it and want to take that home with them and want to come back to see the opera, and you want to make it a staple as Bohème or Traviata in the standard rep. So, and we all believe that. I think from day one, when we all sat down, we got our scores, we had our first musical, we all knew that Moby Dick was going to be something great. And I think we now have a lot of pressure on us in order to bring across how great it is to the audience and how we feel about it, and show the audience that you know, this is an opera that should be around for a very long time.
I should also mention that there are a number of peripheral things happening around the opera production to do with Ahab and Herman Melville, among them tomorrow, this weekend, at the Maritime Museum at 8 in the evening at the Hyde Street Pier. There's going to be a shanty sing at the Hyde Street Pier. On Monday, there's a Litquake Festival that presents Thar She Blows from page to stage, transforming Moby Dick into an opera. And that'll be with Jeffrey Green of the San Francisco State University. That's a free event, Monday evening at 8, for as part of Litquake. And then on Thursday the 11th at the University of California, Berkeley, there's going to be a Moby Dick panel discussion. And California Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park has Moby Dick, A Whale Tale, a conversation with opera folks and the California Academy of Sciences. So all kinds of things that you can learn about at sfopera.com that have to do with the opera Moby Dick. Jake Heggie, that local composer, what a great guy.
He's an incredible guy.
You must be in seventh heaven having this done here again.
You know, there isn't a better person to work for than Jake Heggie. I mean, he when you do a new role like this, you're going off of how you interpret the role until you actually get to sit down with Jake and meet it. So you want to really present yourself well, and you want to make sure that you know it and that you have an idea to bring to the table. And hopefully it's the same idea as Jake's. And Jake isn't a composer that says, well, this is what I want. You have to do this. You have to do this. It's a collaborative effort between everybody, between the artist, the stage director, Lenny, Patrick Summers, the conductor, and Jean Scheer, the librettist, and Jake, the composer. So when you work with Jake, it's almost like he's your father, and he's guiding you through how to take on this massive, massive work like Moby Dick. And he's the sweetest person you'll ever meet in your life. And you know, my wife and I now consider him part of our family, and he's a really great person.
Very nice. I imagine a lot of preparation goes into a role like this. Has the role changed at all since the Dallas production? There's some tweaks here and there.
Maybe slightly, just different staging-wise for lighting purposes and to make certain effects come across clearer. But I think it's... we've all changed a little bit in the way that we've interpreted the roles as well. Because when we did it the first time in Dallas, it was so new, and we were just grasping... I mean, because Moby Dick is a massive, massive piece. And there's so many different layers to the characters and to the characterizations. And every time you do a role, you kind of shed another layer and you interpret it a different way. And I think everyone's doing that. I think everyone's really now just taking their part and looking further into it and trying to not change things purposely, but they're just finding a different aspect of their character that they're now slightly bringing across that as if they didn't do in Dallas. Because it's, and I think it's going to change like that, evolve like that, the more and more that we do this opera, because it is still new.
Now, the opera world swings like a pendulum between directors who prefer more traditional stagings to the more avant-garde contemporary settings of works that sometimes seem doesn't work so well. I'm wondering if you could share with us a production that you've either seen or been involved with, perhaps, that you thought, this is just wrong, or worse, I can't believe I agreed to do this.
Yeah, I have. It's funny, I tell this story to everybody. I had an experience. My first job was singing Elixir in an opera house in France, and I will not say where it is because I don't want to get myself in trouble. But
this is being recorded.
Yeah. But I showed up on the first day, and on the plane, I got an email from my manager that said, you're going to have to wear some sort of a helmet. And I said, I don't quite understand a helmet. I'm doing Elixir of Love. What is this? So I get there, and I'm dressed up as a faun. They want me to be a faun, and Belcore was a rooster, and Adina was a chicken. And I have to tell you, from the beginning of that rehearsal process, I said, this isn't Elixir of Love. This is just some staging with the music to Elixir of Love. And it was just so random and so out there that, that kind of makes me want to do some of the traditional productions because they're not as outlandish as something like that. However, with Moby Dick, it's not so much avant-garde as it is taking a new direction with the way that we can project things on stage. I mean, we have projections of the sea. We have projections of whaleboats, all on this one stage. And it incorporates like this visual media with music and traditional opera that's really, really fantastic. And I think that a lot of people can take what Lenny and Robert Brill and the design team has done with Moby Dick and really maybe take opera in that direction and transform it for the better.
Well, given all the peripheral experiences associated with the opera that's happening all around the Bay Area, I'm sure we'll be hearing more from the creative team of Moby Dick before the eighth and final performance on November 10th. Lots more information at sfopera.com. And if you'd like to hear more from Stephen Costello, click over to stephencostellotenor.com. That's Stephen with a PH, stephencostellotenor.com. So tell me, what's coming up for you after San Francisco?
I'm going to New York to sing on the Richard Tucker Gala. My wife is receiving the award this year.
You were a 2009 winner?
2009, and she's the 2012 winner.
Fantastic.
So very excited about that. And then I make my debut at the Berlin Staatsoper in La Boheme, and then I'm off to San Diego to do my first Tony on Daughter Regiment.
Fantastic.
So it's a pretty busy year.
Well, now, before I say these final three words, I want you to explain what they mean, because I've heard Renee Fleming say it on the HD broadcast all the time. Toy, 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 Stephen.
Oh, it's a form of good luck.
Okay, because really you're not supposed to
break. You're not supposed to say good luck or break a leg in backstage because it's very, you're not supposed to wear purple if you're Italian, so but it's
all right, well, toy, 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 Stephen, and thanks for spending some time with us. Here's a little bit more of Stephen singing from Jake Heggie's opera,
Thank
I
you
see.
Very much.
Sure.
Oh.
Stephen Costello singing another excerpt from I See, music by Jake Heggie. Gene Shear adapting the Herman Melville epic novel, Moby Dick, for SF Opera. Well, lots more details at sfopera.com, including many other events that are happening in association with this massive production. sfopera.com. I'm David Latulippe. Still to come here on Open Air, a talk with Janice Lieberman of the Sierra Ensemble next. Sarah Cahill will be talking with Paul Drescher about the Berklee Symphony Orchestra concert. Plus, I'll have a conversation with Vasily Petrenko. Stay tuned. You're listening to Open Air on KALW San Francisco. Good afternoon. I'm David Latulippe for Alan Farley. Joining me now in studio is Janice Lieberman of the Sierra Ensemble. She's joining me to share some information about a concert that's happening at the Old First Concerts on Friday evening. The Sierra Ensemble is Anita Felix on violin, Janice on horn, and Mike Steiner piano. Janice.
Hi.
Mark Steiner, yes, indeed. Hi, welcome, Janice.
Oh, it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this sounds like a really interesting program, some traditional music as well as some contemporary. Can you tell us a little bit about the program? And, well, first of all, what is the how did the Sierra Ensemble become?
Well, we started in 1998, and three of us got together, wanted to play the Brahms Horn Trio, the most amazing traditional gem for violin, horn, and piano, and then we started to play other repertoire, and our personnel changed a bit, and Anita Felix joined in 2008, and Mark Steiner back in, actually about 10 years ago. And our quest is to develop new repertoire, and we've come across some interesting composers in San Francisco, and also when we were on tour in Istanbul, Turkey, in May of 2011.
Well, this concert tomorrow night is called From the Bosporus to the Bay.
Yes. When we were over in Istanbul last year, we met Tolga Özdemir, who's a fantastic composer. He heard us play Brahms. We started a correspondence with him and some Skype conversations, and he said he would like to write for our trio. And how did we feel about that? We said we'd love it. And we've had some Skype rehearsals. And we are about to present the world premiere tomorrow night.
Fantastic. Let's hear a little bit of that work. What's it called?
It's called Chaopolis.
Ah, there must be a story behind that.
Yeah, it's about the Istanbul. And this is Tolga Özdemir's feelings about the chaotic Istanbul, the life in Istanbul, the fusion of Western instruments, the Eastern rhythm, and an East-West synthesis of musical modes to evoke the confusion and amalgamation of cultures.
Here's a brief excerpt of what you'll hear as a world premiere tomorrow at Old First. Thank you. An excerpt from Tolga Özdemir's Kaopolis, having its world premiere by the Sierra Ensemble tomorrow evening at Old First Concerts. The Sierra Ensemble is Anita Felix, violin, Janice Lieberman, and Mark Steiner on piano. Janice Lieberman, horn player with that ensemble, joining me in studio. Hi again, Janice.
Hi.
That sounds like it's going to be quite a piece.
It's beautiful, and we really enjoy working on it, and we're having fun with it. Tomorrow night, also, we're performing Outburst, San Francisco premiere by Martha Stoddard, San Francisco
Fantastic composer.
Fantastic.
Nice. Very nice.
And Will Flanagan's piece called Chase Scene. Will Flanagan was a student at in Crowded Music Center called the John Adams Young Composers Program, and we met him last year.
Also some Western traditional music on the program?
Yes. We are starting the program with the Georges Barbeteau piece called Esquisse, and then we end with the Brahms trio.
Oh, the Brahms trio for piano, violin, and horn in E-flat major, one of the standards of the repertoire.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's go out with a little bit of that music. Janice, thanks for taking a little bit of time on Open Air today.
Thanks for having us.
Sure, and more information about the Old First concert tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock can be found at their website, oldfirstconcerts.org. Here is the Sierra Ensemble performing a bit of Brahms here on Open Air. The Brahms Trio for Piano, Violin, and Horn in E-flat Major, the Sierra Ensemble, which you can hear the full work tomorrow evening at Old First Concerts, oldfirstconcerts.org for more information. This evening at Zellerbach Hall, the Berklee Symphony Orchestra opens its 2012-13 season with a world premiere by Paul Drescher, Concerto for Quadricord and Orchestra, with music director Joanna Carniero leading the ensemble. Also on the program, Charles Ives' The Unanswered Question and Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Full information at berkleesymphony.org. Pianist Sarah Cahill, host of KALW's Then and Now, talked with composer Paul Drescher about his work this past Sunday. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
I'm Sarah Cahill, and with me now is my very special guest, Paul Drescher. How are you?
It's lovely to be here, Sarah.
Great to see you. You have a premiere this Thursday of your Concerto for Quadricord and Orchestra with the Berklee Symphony. So we're going to be talking about this piece, and it's a commission from the Berklee Symphony, and lots to talk about. But let's begin with the quadricord and what that is.
The quadricord was an instrument that I invented in collaboration with Daniel Schmidt, who's my longtime sort of instrument inventing collaborator. In the late 90s, I had a commission from a group in Minneapolis called Zeitgeist, the chamber music group, and they asked me to create them a piece of music theater of some kind. And so, knowing that musicians make usually pretty poor actors and performance artists, they're not really, most of them aren't equipped to do that, but they play music very well. So I said, okay, I have to make this piece about playing music. And I, from all my years of working with George Coates and then the subsequent stuff that I did with Rindy Eckert, I learned a lot about making theater has to do with scale. One of the important things is scale. The bigger things are, the more impact they make. And it just, it's, you know, that's why opera is grand, is because it just has, it, it makes a certain kind of impact when there's either lots of people or very large things on stage. And I said, okay, I'll build, I used to build musical instruments when I was in high school, and even all through the 70s I built musical instruments, and then I started working with electronics. I said, well, I'm interested in returning to inventing musical instruments, but now with my knowledge of theater, I can sort of approach it in a different way. And I said, I'll build a set. The whole set will be musical instruments, and they'll be very big. some of the instruments will be very large. And to reverse the paradigm of usually a musician holds the instrument, in this case I wanted to build something big enough that the instrument would hold the musician as opposed to the musician holding the instrument. So I built a variety of things, and one of them was this instrument, the quadricord. And the quadricord is an instrument that's got, about 16 feet long. It's got four strings, four steel strings, and there's pickups at the end of each string. The string length is about 140 inches. So it's like, you know, it's like five, six times as long as a violin string or a guitar string, something like that. It's very long. And the fundamental notes are very low. And it turned out to be an instrument that I fell in love with in the course of composing the piece Soundstage. And said, I want to explore this instrument much more. And so since the piece premiered in 2001, I've used the quadricord in a number of concert works and in music theater works and in dance scores and in duos that I do with Joel Duvall, the percussionist that I regularly work with. And so the instrument's been around. I've been using it a lot for the last dozen years, mostly in small-scale contexts, duos, or chamber music, and or in music theater, and so or the Margaret Jenkins Dance Company, a big score I did with the piece, and called A Slipping Glimpse in 2006. So when the idea of doing a piece for the Berklee Symphony was sort of floated, I said, you know, I think I'm ready to see if I can make this instrument work in a much larger ensemble context. Obviously, the largest one being the orchestra. And so initially, I thought I was going to do a concerto for two of my invented instruments, one the quadricord and the other is a piece called the Hurdy Grande, which is an instrument that was invented for a subsequent music theater piece, a piece called Schick Machine. As I was composing the work, I realized there was an abundance of material that was coming up for the quadricord, and that the combination of the abundance of material that I had and the complex logistics of having two big instruments on stage, keeping them in tune, moving them on and off stage, just seemed like, why should I do that? And the formal coherence of the work seemed to be much harder to integrate two completely different instruments into the work. So if this work is successful, maybe eventually I will write a concerto for the Hurdy-Grande and orchestra.
How many quadricords do you have?
Well, there's really only one extant. Well, that's actually not true. The set for Schick Machine set for Soundstage had two of them, that show hasn't been done since 2006. Those instruments still exist, but they're packed away. But the instrument that I'm using on concert now, and like the one that we used at the museum about a year and a half ago, that one is built from aluminum. Daniel and I built that one to be a touring instrument. It needed to break down easily and set up quickly and travel in a very, in checkable luggage. And so we built it out of, it's almost like an aluminum I-beam is really what it is. And even though it's 16 feet long, it breaks down into very coherent and packable modules that aren't heavy, and so it travels in two cases. So that's the instrument that I'm using now. I have to say that when we built them out of wood, even though there was no resonating chamber, there was a warmth to the sound that this particular version doesn't really have. And I can restore it to some extent with equalization or electronics, but it's not the same as a wooden instrument. It's an instrument that has to be amplified. Even though the strings are vibrating and I'm bowing them, I'm plucking them, I'm doing all the things we do on an acoustic instrument, it has to be amplified. It produces as much acoustic sound as an electric guitar, a hard-body electric guitar.
Let's listen to some music with the quadricord. And this is chromatic quadricord.
Right.
What is it?
Chromatic quadricord it was sort of a study piece that I wrote. It was the first piece that I wrote for the quadricord and other instruments. And it was written for Soundstage. And it's for the quadricord plays this very long ascending harmonic progression going through. I neglected to say in my first sort of statement about the long strings and the quadricord what it does completely differently than a traditional Western instruments is it plays the harmonic series. It has a difficult time playing equal temperament, the tuning that we have on the piano, tuning that all musicians spend, years practicing to play in tune with. My instrument plays very easily and with great facility and accuracy the intervals of the harmonic series, which sounds complicated, but it is a very important different approach to tuning. It's an approach to tuning that obviously Lou Harrison was very involved with, that Harry Partch based his whole instruments on the need. His need to build instruments was the need to work with tuning systems based on the harmonic series and to have many more intervals than just the the intervals that we typically achieve on the piano or on equal temperament. And my instrument plays very high in the harmonic series, up to like, well, I actually play up to the 43rd harmonic in this piece, but I regularly am negotiating up to the 28th harmonic. So a lot of those intervals are wildly out of tune with the equal temperament. And but they're in tune with, you could say, quote unquote, they're in tune with nature. And so this work, Chromatic Quadrichord, is a work where I start at the 8th harmonic and I go up to the 17th harmonic, and I use, and on four different strings, I'm using different harmonics at different times, so that at times we are in tune with equal temperament, and that you'll hear the marimba and you'll hear a piano playing, and generally speaking, they're in tune when they're playing. And then you'll hear clarinet and violin, and they're often used because they're both more pitch-wise flexible. They will be used where I'm in those more remote harmonic areas, like the 11th harmonic, the 13th harmonic, the 14th harmonic. These are all intervals that are pretty far away from equal temperament. Mm. So this is that's what the, it's about an 8-minute long piece. I think this recording I have here is actually the recording that I did with Zeitgeist, taken from the performance of a piece called Soundstage. But this is Chromatic Quadrichord.
Okay. Music by Paul Drescher.
A brief taste of some of the sounds of the quadrichord, an instrument invented by composer Paul Drescher. Thanks to Sarah Cahill for that conversation. Paul's Concerto for Quadrichord and Orchestra, along with Charles Ives' The Unanswered Question, and Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, will be performed with music director Joanna Carneiro leading the ensemble tonight at 7 o'clock with a gala dinner honoring Paul Drescher following. Again, a 7 p.m. start to that concert this evening. Full information at berkeleysymphony.org. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe. And next, visiting with Vasily Petrenko, who is in town to lead the San Francisco Symphony in music of Ottorino Respighi, Béla Bartók, and Arvo Pärt this week. Maestro, welcome back to San Francisco.
Thank you.
You're no stranger to this particular group of musicians, as you made your San Francisco Symphony debut in 2010, conducting works of Shostakovich and Grieg, and last appeared here in October of last year.
Yeah, it's for me a big pleasure every time to come to San Francisco and to conduct San Francisco Symphony. They're a great band, and I always have fun and a great time with them.
Well, before we talk about the specifics of your program with the symphony this weekend, could you share with us your impression of San Francisco? You say you're no stranger here compared to, say, other American cities you may have guest conducted in or visited.
I'd say that San Francisco is one of the few cities in America which I like. Sorry to say. I really adore United States. But I'm born in St. Petersburg, the city full of history. St.
Sure.
Petersburg, Russia, not St. Petersburg, Florida, by the way. And the city full of history. Whenever I'm coming to America, this is spot which I'm missing. Sometime you see beautiful buildings, you see downtowns, you see fantastic villas surrounded by parks and great people. But what you're missing is this historical background, which have happened in Europe for centuries. And America is a very young country. very successful and a great country to live. However, I would like to have more historical background in the city and environment. And in San Francisco, it's a lot of that. You can see a lot of historical buildings. You can see basically everything starting from Golden Gates and going to the city. You see replicas of many historical monuments of the world. You see the other parts. If you go in the bay to the other side of the bay, you see historical villas and some fantastic places.
Also a big connection to Russia.
Obviously, yeah, as people say, Russians just stopped a few miles from San Francisco, and the Fort Ross is very close, and also Russian Hill in the city, and a lot of Russians live in the city. But I'd say it's a lot of Russians lives everywhere now. Wherever I'm coming, there are always Russian language surrounding me, even if I don't know personally people, you always can hear that. But I love San Fran because of this period, and also it's some atmosphere of freedom in the city, in the town, which is difficult to say what it's really about. It's something like the walking style of the people on those steep hills. It's probably how the people behave each other, how they talk to each other. You can see that this air of freedom, this character of freedom, is very present in the city, and it has been present, and it will be present.
It's one thing I've noticed, especially in the difference, say, between New York audiences and San Francisco audiences. In a San Francisco audience, it actually does get completely quiet before a conductor brings his baton down. And then New York, I've heard, you know, coughs and talking. And
it depends. I must say, in my concerts here, that it's been always rather quiet, especially at the beginning, but it depends on the season. Sometimes it's a flu season and it's unavoidable. Sometimes it's a season when everybody calling each other and then you hear mobile phones or you hear messages, you hear some other noises. Sometimes now, I must say, quite often the noise of hearing apparatus, and they can be very noisy.
Interesting. Now, as a young conductor, you were born in 1976. You've already established some very deep roots in Liverpool, England, of all places, as music director of the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. Now, how did that relationship start?
It started from a call, as it always starts. Basically, Liverpool Philharmonic has had a concert and haven't got conductor for that, and they had very low budget. Happened in 2004. And they called my agent in IMG Artists and asked, do you have any young conductor who can come for such an amount of money? And the salary was really, really low for this first concert. And then basically I came there, and concert went quite successful. The audience made a standing ovation. And then from then it started to progress towards something bigger and bigger.
And has become almost permanent at this point. You've been renewed. You're now music director.
Yeah, we do have a great concerts, and I still think I declared at the beginning that my aim, my target is to make the orchestra as number one in the world. And Liverpool is adorable and great city, but it's not London, it's not New York. People don't think about themselves as number one in the world unless it's Friday night. So I declared it, and then slowly but surely we moved to the right direction. I still think there are plenty of things to do.
Imagine touring is then a part of your equation for this, getting more of a world reputation going.
We're doing quite a few tours now. Of course, it's difficult with current economy situation everywhere. However, we just in 2 weeks we're going to Spain for a tour, and then there are some other tours planned in around. We hope that the tour which we planned for United States will happen in about 2 years' time from now. But nowadays, nobody can say what's going to happen unless it's really happened.
Right.
So that's a lot. For me, the biggest pride of Liverpool, that the audience grew up over the years for 65%. And now we have average over 90% sold tickets.
Fantastic.
And most of the concerts are sold out. We're now extending the concert programs. We started new coffee time concerts, for instance, just to accommodate the people who can't go the evenings. Mm-hmm. So to give them a chance to watch the orchestra. It's weekdays at noon. 1 hour concert, short program with introduction from me. For instance, we also enlarged Sunday series because Sunday was not a traditional day to come for a British audience. Now it becomes more and more popular. And we also enlarge our presence in London and the other cities. So I think that it's a great time for the orchestra. It still have big potential where to go. 2015 will be very big year for the orchestra, 175 years anniversary. And we're looking forward for all fronts.
Very nice. Now, you've expressed a very strong commitment to music education, especially in England, where you're now also the conductor of the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. And you're one of several conductors who've endorsed a program that allows British school children to get free entry to classical music concerts. Now, you're all of 36 years old. Do you find a resurgence of interest to classical music and orchestral music and the young people you interact with today, or is there a generational gap, especially given all the electronic distractions that youth can get involved in these days?
I would say that at the moment, how the society functioning, the natural gap which happens, because when you come as a child to the concert, you perhaps you enjoy the music, but you're surrounded by the other chaps, and then they enjoy Angry Birds more than classical music. And that's what you need to be very strong to counterpoint your opinion to them.
Right.
Then when you became to be a student, you have other interests. Instead of classical music concert, you would go to the pub. You will date a girl. You'll just do many things. And you're relatively poor. You don't have enough budget to spend on the classical music. It's not expensive, but you have other issues to spend money on.
Sure.
Then the family time starts. And when you're starting to have a family, you have young kids, to come to the concert, you need to find a babysitter or a nurse. Then it's difficult, and it's also expensive.
Sure,
and
sure.
Then you can't accommodate that. And it's only roughly after 45, when the kids are grew up, when they can take care about themselves. And when people usually realize that there are a lot of free time in their life. And then quite a lot of them return to classical music because they realize the real value of the classical music.
You've attributed your strong music education to being in large part a product of what turned out to be the end of the Soviet system. I'm wondering, did you have exposure in that education to people outside of the USSR at that point when you were in your formative years?
I wouldn't say exposure. I'm very grateful to Soviet educational system. We were in a very lucky, for us, lucky time. And the generation of musicians and conductors from ex-Soviet Union now is very rich because we got a great Soviet education system plus great European and American experience. And a combination of both giving fantastic results, I think. And the greatest thing about Soviet system was that when I've been studying in St. Petersburg Conservatoire, every single week I had ability to come to real orchestra. So real people, at least 1 hour, you spend in front of the real orchestra. And it makes massive difference. So far as I know, the similar system introduced in Scandinavia, Sibelius Academy in Helsinki. That's why it's so many successful Finnish conductors nowadays. In Stockholm, they're starting to introduce the system. And in Vienna, but in Vienna, it's just once a month. It's not every week.
And in Venezuela, of course, with
Venezuela, yes, that's very different story, I think. The phenomenon of Venezuela is not only the educational system. It's the only chance for many people to go abroad and to be successful outside of the country. And I think success inside the country, inside Venezuela, is quite limited, especially for classical musicians.
Interesting.
So for them, it's a very big competition inside the country just to go abroad. It's the same what happened in Soviet Union. Musicians which you know, the world-renowned musicians from Soviet time, they passed all the internal competitions just to represent the country.
How do you think things are faring post-Soviet system?
In some things it's better, in some things it's worse, as always. Musicians nowadays, they paid better than it used to be in the 90s, for instance. The best orchestra, the top orchestras in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and some regional cities, they have decent salaries. But I'd say that at the same time, the educational programs from the government, they much decreased comparing to Soviet time. And now the country more oriented towards sport rather than culture. And of course, you can argue with that because it gives nation more health, ultimately. If everybody makes sports, not drinks, that's better for the health of the country. But there are some cultural aspects which is missing sometime.
Sure, sure.
And comparing to, once again, to Soviet times, it's by far less attention from the government to all cultural benefits which culture can give to the audience and to the public.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this week's symphony program. Arvo Pärt Fratr is in the program. Now, there's 16 different versions of this particular piece. The one you've chosen to do is for strings and percussion. Are you familiar with some of the other versions that Pärt
has made?
Yeah,
there are quite a few other versions. Perhaps the most famous is for solo violin and piano, or for solo violin and the orchestra. But the part for violin is not written. It's more improvising.
Hmm.
On the subject and on the harmonies of this minimalistic style on which Arvo Pärt has written this piece.
For audiences that may be listening that don't know the style of Arvo Pärt, it's very meditative, at least this phase of his life when he wrote this piece. It's very contemplative.
I think for him, he tried to write 12-tone system music, but he's been highly rejected by the Composers Union of Soviet Union by then. And then I think he started first it as a protest. Okay, you don't want to very complicate things in style. Let's try to do something very, very basic. But then with his study of Orthodox choral music, with his study of meditation, with his study of Indian culture, he found that it's very profound and it's deeply moving music and deeply moving style. And it's his words that he say that even one note played at the perfect pitch sounds much better than 200 notes played at average pitch.
How do you like the music? Is it a chance for you to just breathe deep and relax for a moment during a concert and in rehearsal? Is it something that you approach differently?
I would say less notes is more difficult.
Uh-huh.
Because you're at the spotlight all the time. And as a conductor, I always feel responsible for what is the sound from the orchestra right now, right here. And less notes you have, less sounds from the orchestra, you feel more responsibility for each of them. It is a tough piece to conduct. You need to have patience. You need to have courage.
Mm-hmm.
You need to calculate the pace exactly and crescendo in this piece. It's not easy. It sounds easy, but if it's played wrongly, it doesn't give you any effect. You think it's a very boring piece. But if it's played right, it's amazing music.
Very moving. Also on the program, Bartok's Piano Concerto No. 3 with Jean-Eflam Bavouzet making his piano debut. Now, I think most audiences will be more familiar with other Bartok works like the Concerto for Orchestra or even the string quartets, but not so much the three piano concerti, I think, of which this final one, number 3 was written in 1945, the year of his death.
Yeah, he basically haven't finished last 17 bars of it. He just given instructions how to finish the concerto before going to hospital where he died 4 days after.
Wow.
And in this last concerto, the style of this last concerto is very different from first two concertos because by then he probably knew that he will never be able to play himself. And it's more in style for as his wife would play that. That's why it's much more simple, much more gentle than number 1 and number 2. Much more melodical and very transparent in orchestration. It's an amazing piece of music, one of the real jewels of 20th century. And it's like last words. It's very interesting that the composers at the end, when they knew that the time is passing, they've been writing such transparent and transcendental music. It's many examples of that.
Mm-hmm. And then also on the program, Respighi's Fountains and Pines of Rome. And I think we really do have a Russian to thank for the splendid orchestration of Respighi, who studied with Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov several times, and who has to be, I think, the best orchestrator of, I wish, modern composers. Every modern composer would have to study Rimsky-Korsakov. I'm wondering if you see that kind of orchestral knowledge and breadth of orchestration in today's composers.
You're right. Rimsky-Korsakov is perhaps the best ever exists orchestrator. And you can study that. He's written a book about orchestration, so at least you can read that. And Respighi studied with him, but he also had other teachers. And it's in those pieces a lot of influence of French impressionism, a lot of Debussy, Ravel style. There are a lot of influence of Strauss music, and it's very interesting how it's all blends together. And of course, it's pictures of Rome. Whenever I'm in Rome, I've been there a couple of times, next time coming in January, and when I see the places, the fountains, or the pine alleys, immediately you can hear this music. It's natural. It's unbelievable. It's not movie music. Not at all. It's much deeper and much more profound. And it's a music of true spirit of Rome. It's very difficult to say which element exactly gives this feeling, but you really like you breeze by the air of Rome.
Where do you go after San Francisco? What's next on your calendar?
It's quite a busy period. I'm going for 3 days to Liverpool, preparing orchestra for tour and doing concerts in Liverpool. And then it's 3 days in Berlin, conducting Echo Award ceremony in Berlin. Then just 1 day back home, and then tour to Spain. And after last concert, miraculously, I need to travel overnight to Vienna, because then it's rehearsal in Vienna. It's rather difficult, but I'll be back to United States in November, December, coming to Washington, L.A., then Montreal and Chicago.
Vasily Petrenko, I wish you well, and thank you for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to spend some time with us here at KLW.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the concerts.
Here is the first movement of Ottorino's Respighi's Fountains of Rome, the Fountain of the Giulia Valley at dawn, to be part of this weekend's concerts with the San Francisco Symphony.
the Fountain of the Giulia Valley at dawn. The first movement of Ottorino Respighi's Fountains of Rome. That recording was with James DePriest and the Oregon Symphony. You can hear that work performed with Vasily Petrenko and the San Francisco Symphony this weekend. Information at sfsymphony.org. Well, given just the breadth of this program today, there's certainly no lack of things for you to do on the cultural front this weekend, especially with the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival in Golden Gate Park. 3 days of that. Boy, it seems like the entire city is a 12-ring circus in the weekend ahead. And if you'd like to wind things down on Sunday evening, I invite you to join me from 8 to 10 as I'll be guest host for Sarah K. Helfer Then and Now, 2 hours of classical and new music with a healthy dose of the well-tempered clavier of Johann Sebastian Bach, courtesy of pianist Andras Schiff, who will be performing recitals of books 1 and 2 of Well-Tempered Clavier on October 7th and 21st, respectively, through the San Francisco auspices of the San Francisco Symphony. Schiff will also conduct and perform with the symphony in 3 concerts of music by Bach and Mendelssohn, plus an open rehearsal on October 11th, and will give a talk and play examples of the music of Bach on stage on October 9th, and then return for 2 more recitals in the spring of this coming year. And KLW's partnership with SF Performances continues Monday at 9 through the end of November. I'm your host for Explorations in Music, David LaTulipe, with this current series exploring the life and music of Franz Schubert with the Alexander String Quartet and the always entertaining and informative music historian Robert Greenberg. More information at our website, kalw.org. Litquake 2012 presents over 800 authors during the 9 days of this year's festival. More information at litquake.org. Litquake runs October 5th through the 13th. This is Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, where news from the BBC is next.